I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Madmen, the show revolving around John Hamm's portrayal of Don Draper, creative director at Manhattan Advertising Agency in the 1960s, ends its fifth season this Sunday night. It's a riveting and fascinating program. A lot of people think so, too. The season premiere in March had some 3.5 million viewers, the highest in the series run. The Twitter chatter on Sunday night is maddening if you haven't seen the episode yet, and come Monday, the online discussion on Sundry recap blogs is time-consuming in their detail. The writers at the AV Club, Slate, New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, Salon, the New York Times, and a few more I'm forgetting, are wonderfully pedantic, thorough, and thoughtful. We'll look at the season that was with a view to what we're expecting Sunday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on AMC. Joining me today is Christine Hall. She is the Director of Communications at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a Washington-based think tank. She's a Mad Men fan and comes highly recommended. She served as a policy analyst for Steve Forbes when he was running for the presidency in 2000 and Mark Sanford when he was a congressman. She was also a reporter for CNS News. It'll be interesting to get her perspective. The website for the Institute is at CEI.org. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Christine Hall. Ms. Hall, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us. Mark Sanford, was that the guy that resigned as governor of South Carolina?
Very same.
Yes. Okay, so you worked for him. He was a congressman, I guess, before he...
Right, he was a member of Congress, and he had self-term limited himself to 2 terms, as I recall. Perhaps it was 3, but in any case, he wanted to move on and do some other things with his career and became governor.
And we all know what happened there. so let's start to with how you came to Mad Men. Did you watch the series from the beginning?
You know, I think I was a little bit behind when I first started watching it. I think what I ended up doing was actually catching up, in a whirlwind over a weekend or two, really catching up on first season, so that by the time second season started, I was all caught up.
Yeah, I did the same. I think I was in the middle of the third or fourth season. And then okay. I got all the DVDs and then came. It was hard to get into, I found, even the pilot. I had to watch it 2 or 3 times before I actually got it. Did you find
that? Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you put it up there as one of the greatest series in the history of TV?
You know, I don't know how to rank anything like that. I'm not actually a huge TV watcher. You know, I don't watch loads of other shows, so it's hard for me to make that comparison. What I will say is that I think that it's probably one of the best series in terms of getting the look of the era correctly. I mean, I think you see a lot of especially lately, you see a lot of kind of retro shows or shows focused on past eras. And so I think this is a really high-quality series in that regard, and really, you know, being very conscientious about getting the look right, about the references to history right. And so I think it's part of kind of a cadre of recent shows that are doing just very well at that. So I would say in that regard, it's probably one of the best series of all time.
And this fashion of having sort of retro shows, is that something that do you think that we needed at this time? Sort of thinking, say, politically or culturally, that there was a gap that needed to be filled, say?
Well, probably. I just think it's delightful. I mean, you have, Downton Abbey, which is a series in Britain that's now shown on PBS here, and that's kind of, the Titanic era into the 1920s. And then, of course, Boardwalk Empire, which is set kind of in the Prohibition era in the U.S. And I've just been recently rediscovering a series called Foyle's War, which is set in World War II, and it is also a British series from the 90s that I don't know how I didn't know about before. But, I was sort of reading an article talking about the sort of resurgence of these kind of retro shows and the mad scramble on the part of costumers to actually, find... like sets and costumes and accessories, props to go along with it, because it's not easy.
Yeah, and because I sort of wondered, obviously ratings and making money is something that motivates a lot of Hollywood, a lot of TV production, film production, but maybe culturally the viewer, maybe they were looking for something.
Yeah, it's interesting that, just to take Mad Men as an example of that, I think it wasn't actually that long ago in history, the 1960s, but I think people are really fascinated by the politically incorrect lifestyles, the scripts, settings. And so maybe that is something in this kind of age of political correctness. Maybe we do need to sort of remember time for better and for worse, where it was less PC.
Yeah. And the acting's pretty good, isn't it?
Well, I think it's outstanding. I mean, this is extremely well cast. I mean, it's really a top-rate show. They really, I mean, I can't even think of a weak link among the characters.
Yeah. In terms of the portrayal of women, I mean, you just touched on the sort of the politically incorrect aspect of I guess, the times or the difference in from our time to their time. The portrayal of women, that's been fascinating this season. We've seen that with sort of the main female characters in the show. Something's happened to Joan, Peggy, and to a certain extent Betty this season. What do you make of how their characters have evolved?
Well, I think if you look at the time period that Mad Men covers, the 1960s, it's a very transitional period for women and for African Americans as well. And I think, you know, if you look at the 1940s, right, I mean, the young men were all sort of off at war, and the women were in the factories, in the workplace. And then when the men came home from war, women were sort of cast out of that role and back into the home. And then and that was sort of throughout the 1950s. But by the 1960s, you know, you have kind of a generational change going on. So you have the baby boom generation coming of age, and, you know, so much changing with civil rights and with interest with women's interests. Renewed interest in careers. So I think what you're seeing is, you know, in a way, sort of the Betty character, who is the wife of, now actually the ex-wife of Don Draper, I mean, she's almost like more old school, like more sort of that like 1950s stay-at-home mom kind of mentality. But then if you look at somebody like Peggy, who's a bit younger than Betty, or even Don Draper's current wife, Megan, I mean, these are sort of younger women who expect to have a career, you know, who expect to not just be, and I don't mean to, you know, suggest it's not important, but I mean, they don't see themselves as homemakers, you know, they see themselves as women with careers. And I think it's interesting, like the Peggy character, which I don't know if she's going to continue on in the show. There's been some doubt cast about that, but I mean, she actually, you know, has a child out of wedlock and essentially, you know, gives the child to her family and doesn't seem to participate in that child's life. So it's clear to me that, you know, she doesn't see herself as a mom, as a homemaker. You know, she sees herself as a career girl. And in the case of Don's wife, Megan, I mean, she's pursuing an acting career. And I think there was one part in the series, in a recent episode, where she kind of discounted the notion of having children and, you know, having that family. So I think, you know, for the younger women, I mean, they are trying to show this kind of transition away from what was in the 1950s.
So in one of the recent episodes, Peggy, who's a really good a creative person in terms of creating ads and the sort, she leaves the firm because she feels underappreciated and so on. The last time we saw her was going to the elevator, and unfortunately in the last episode, she didn't appear. Her character didn't appear. Do you think if that character was lost from the show, it'd be a huge loss for Mad Men?
Well, the show was so well written that, you know, I would have hopes that no matter what they come up with or whatever cast members they eliminate, that it would still continue to be a very excellently written series. But I think that Peggy was, you know, arguably the most interesting character on Mad Men, so it would be a shame to lose her in that sense. I mean, she's really kind of been a trailblazer, I think, when she, you know, got her job as in the creative department of the ad agency. I mean, she was the only woman who, at least at that agency, she was maybe like the first and the only woman in that role. And I think, you know, if she exits, I mean, she's gone from the firm, but I mean, you know, Joan is now a partner in the firm. But I mean, in terms of that sort of creative, in that creative sense, it would be a loss, I think, to the show. I mean, you know, you still have, you know, Megan, who's a very strong character, and like I said, the character Joan, who's now a partner in the firm, through sort of we'll just say very unusual circumstances.
Indeed.
But yeah, I think I think people really look to Peggy to do something that's new and different and trailblazing. So I think she would certainly be missed.
And did you find, as I did, that there wasn't a bad episode this season?
You know, I've never thought there was a bad episode. I'm not saying that every single episode was from every season was, you know, outstanding. But I would be hard pressed to think of one that I considered bad. I've been happy with this season because you never really know what to expect from one episode to another. I mean, the way that the show is written, you just don't know who's going to exit, or, and I guess in more recently, who's going to suddenly, be done in.
Yeah. Yeah, in the United States, is there data, say, on who watches the show? I mean, it's on AMC, which is, I guess, not basic cable in America. The audience tends to be rather affluent. Is that correct?
That wouldn't surprise me. I haven't seen the demographics on that. I think an interesting aspect of the show is that a lot of the writers are women, from what I understand. And, I find that interesting because they write the men, quite a few of the men, into just being sort of, cads. I mean, the characters are complicated, so it's not that they're sort of all bad, but it's interesting that you have female writers, writing sort of a script for a sort of cheating, lying, no good husbands.
Yeah. And in terms of politics, my understanding is that people from all political persuasions tend to like the show. I mean, from the president on down, I guess, right?
Yeah, actually, I don't really view the show as political. I mean, there are references to current events, to, for example, the Nixon-Johnson race in 1960, but it's not actually an overtly political show, at least not in my opinion. Maybe others sort of perceive more of a political bit, but I think, it's just so well written. The characters are really kind of complicated. It's interesting that, none of the characters, at least in my opinion, are perfectly likable. I mean, you don't get sort of the white hat, black hat divide. But I think it does appeal to people of all political persuasions because it is well written. And I think that, some people, for political purposes, like to have that smug, sort of superior, oh, well, we're so much better than that now,
Yeah.
So I think there's an element of that as well for viewers, for some viewers.
And the depiction of politics, I mean, you mentioned some of the Nixon-Kennedy stuff
right. That
was in the early seasons. Bert is a devotee of Ayn Rand.
Right, there's a few references to that. It's not really well-developed, but there's a few references to it.
Yeah, do you find that the depiction of say, day-to-day politics, that's accurate?
Well, it's actually referenced so little that, it's... I know people have quibbled with aspects of it. For example, Henry, who is the Betty Draper character's new husband. He works for Rockefeller and in New York, Governor Rockefeller.
Yeah.
And I think there's been some people who've quibbled with aspects of how that's portrayed. But it's really such a minor, at least in my view, such a minor part of what happens. It's kind of referenced, but it's not really. It's not really treated in any kind of detailed way, and I am fairly sensitive to that because I do work for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, so I'm kind of immersed in sort of politics and policy in Washington, and I'm used to seeing Hollywood portray business is bad or, greed is bad, or the sort of the usual go-to sort of Hollywood-style portrayals. But I haven't actually seen that much of it represented in Mad Men. I actually kind of call Mad Men, it's kind of like, in my opinion, it's kind of like a soap opera set in the 1950s. It's really more kind of about the characters than it is any sort of political bent.
But there was an episode where Henry, you mentioned Betty's husband, he works for Rocco. He used to work for Lindsay, John Lindsay, the former mayor of New York, or the mayor at the time of New York. He took a shot at Romney, George Romney, which is, I guess, Mitt Romney's father. Did you notice that in this past season?
I saw it discussed a little bit afterwards, but I blinked and missed that part of the show. But I did see some discussion about various people sort of being offended at that.
Yeah, it just seemed, because I guess I don't know much about George Romney, but I guess Rockefeller considered him a lightweight, and so he says something about Romney, and it was ironic that it was in the time of all the, you know, the Republican nomination stuff. So
yeah, and you
it was
know,
just
but
good timing, I guess. Yeah,
right. And but I have a feeling that you know, whatever the writers had in mind, I mean, the reference to this sort of thing is just so kind of brief, you know, that at least in my view, it's hard to read too much into that.
Yeah, some of the things that happened this season, and if people listening haven't watched, haven't come up to where we are, I guess, in terms of where the show is, in terms of the episodes, or having watched the episodes, Lane's suicide last week. What I really enjoyed about that, not necessarily seeing him die, but was how they told the story of how he tried to go about, you know, killing himself. The Jaguar not
right.
starting, you know, and all that.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it was quite funny. Obviously his death wasn't humorous, but the writers had been... Actually, we were having a discussion about this here at CEI yesterday. We have a member of our staff who is British, and we were kind of talking about, well, so what was this with Jaguar in the 1960s? Like, was it really a terrible car? And we were having this conversation about how... how it had been, like, terribly, like, the electrical system was really bad or something, but that it was, like, sort of a beautiful car with a great engine.
Yeah.
And so the writers kind of drew that out in this past episode where the character, Lane Price, is trying to kill himself, and he's trying to do it through, you know, carbon monoxide poisoning, and the car won't start. So it's kind of... You know, the characters had been discussing kind of the problems of Jaguars, that it was kind of a lemon or something, and then it's, you know, they sort of, I guess that's a bit of their dark sense of humor in that plot element.
Yeah, and in the last, this past episode, Glenn, this weird kid who used to be a neighbor of theirs when they lived, I guess, in the suburbs, he and Don's daughter, Sally, they have... they have quite an interesting relationship, the two of them, and he comes to the city, and they meet up. What did you make of that storyline?
You know, it's interesting that they've really been drawing Sally out as a character, and really, you know, we're getting to know her better as she gets older, and, you know, I think they're trying to some extent... You know, for example, Sally gets her period this past episode,
right.
So they're trying to show kind of a young girl coming of age. I mean, they've shown kind of Peggy and Megan as like young women, you know, finding their place in the workforce and finding their place in society. But it seems as if with the Sally character, maybe they're trying to show, okay, yes, here's even a younger generation kind of coming up, you know, who again won't be like the generation before her. And, you know, maybe they're trying to show, I don't know, you know, with this, with her childhood friend, you know, maybe it's maybe like it's like sort of a coming of age of, you know, having a boy like that as a friend who she's not even sure whether she wants as a boyfriend, but seems to kind of think that she might. So I'm not sure where they're going with that. I mean, it's interesting, I mean, the fact that they've kept that character around, the neighborhood kid, even though... no one lives in that neighborhood anymore, and they're in sort of different places. The fact that they've kept that around, I guess, makes me think that they're going somewhere with kind of a Sally entering, you know, her teenage years and you know, sort of growing up. They must be drawing that out in some direction.
He's also Matthew Weiner's kid, I understand, the guy that plays Glenn.
Oh, my gosh, I did not realize that.
Yeah, so that's probably why they're keeping him around, if you ask
Interesting.
Me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's probably right.
Yeah.
He's kind of like, you know, a bit chubby and awkward.
Yeah.
I mean, that actually is interesting. He's he's like a little bit wooden, maybe, compared to some of the other characters. But I mean, I guess that would that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. What do you think will happen Sunday?
You know, I hesitate to guess because I you know, every episode is a surprise. I mean, right now, you know,
yeah.
You have Lane Price's death, and I think you'll see the character still dealing with that. It'll be really interesting to see whether Peggy makes an appearance. If she doesn't, I think that is probably a harbinger of next season,
yeah.
Which I understand may or may not be the last season. I mean, there seems to be a lot of speculation about that. they've had major plot twists in each of the past two episodes, and that's not even, they weren't even the season finale.
Yeah.
So it seems to me, they're going to have to top what they've done, and I don't know how you top the death of Lane Price, because I think if you don't top that in terms of dramatic effect, then people are going to walk away saying, oh, well, you know, it certainly ended like on an anticlimactic note, and I don't think that's what the writers want. So you had Peggy leaving the firm. You had Lane Price committing suicide. What are they going to do next? I don't know, but it's bound to be something big.
Yeah, Weiner used to write for The Sopranos, and looking back at the season finales of Mad Men, I tend to remember that they weren't all, none of them really were, had anything, you know, there was no Who Shot J.R. or anything in any of the finales, and I think that's something that he got from David Chase on The Sopranos, where everything happened right before the finale. It made you want to watch the next season, but there was nothing like, you know, like Joan sleeping with a Jaguar salesman or Peggy leaving or the sort. In terms of this season more than any other season, because I read an interview with Matthew Weiner where he said that he didn't want the show to end in the 60s. And so he had hoped, and I don't know if this will be borne out in the future, that the show, that we would see the characters up to, say, today, because I guess Don Draper would be in his 80s or 90s now. Do you wonder about how these characters turn out?
Well, I think the writers are clearly pointing them in certain directions. I mean, I think they are trying to portray certainly Roger Sterling and even Don Draper as they're trying to portray them as, in certain respects, kind of has-beens, mm-hmm. which I think is really not altogether fair. But, oh, well, once you hit 40 or 50, you're a has-been. I mean, I think that's a bit, you know, it's a bit overstated in a way. But you can see that they're sort of, you know, kind of contrasting them with younger generations and suggesting that the future is not theirs. The future belongs to, you know, this younger generation of women and blacks, and even, you know, like Sally, as I said, they're kind of bringing her up in that respect. So, you know, I think that the writers seem to view sort of Don and Roger as kind of icons of the past. So it seems to me that going forward, they will probably, however far they take into the future, they'll probably continue to kind of emphasize how, you know, perhaps out of touch they are with, like, pop culture, or with kind of the mentality of young people. I have a feeling that that is, you know, what they would try to draw out going forward.
Christine, this has been fun. I appreciate your time today, and I just want to thank, I guess, Rachel Marsden for recommending you. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, and thanks to Rachel very much, and thanks to you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
The website for more, CEI.org. Christine Hall is the Director of Communications at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. She's on the line from Washington, D.C. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunton.